Hey guys, I'm Tara, and I am actually the world's most devoted pug servant. When I first got my dogs, I have two pugs, girls, they're 6 years old, Aiko and Sumiko, aikoandmiko.com. I got them from the pound, but I started doing a little research on pugs as a breed. And one thing that I learned was historically, pugs were actually bred for the Japanese imperial palaces. And when they were first bred, every pug in the palace got their own servant. And so I think my dogs are actually always a little disappointed that they have to share a servant. But we work it out. They have a very discerning taste level. All right, guys, we have a ton to talk about. I'm going to try to stick with my 45 minutes. But I do want to take one moment before we get started and ask you to come along with me on a group vulnerability exercise, if you will. So I want you to make eye contact with someone at your table, pick a partner, just pick someone, and we're going to spend exactly 2 minutes, I'll time you. I want you to share with your partner the answer to this question. Tell them one thing that you're afraid of. It can be a fear in life, in love, in work. You get 60 seconds, and I'll tell you when to switch. Okay, time's up. Time's up, time's up. Time's up, guys. So how was that? Was that weird? Was it weird to talk about that to someone you don't know? I suspect that coming out of that sharing moment that we just had, you will find fascinating the fact that I'm about to share with you. I find it fascinating that this little guy and all newborn human beings are born with two fears and two fears only. We are born, and actually, before I tell you, what I want you to do is I'm going to say what the two fears are, and then if the two fears I name were not in the list of fears that you talked with your new friend about, I want you to raise your hand, okay, after I say what they are. The two fears humans are born with are the fear of falling and the fear of loud noises. So if your friend did not say either of those fears, raise your hand. All right. So lesson number one is that we all need to have very intense conversations with our parents when we go home tonight, because something happened along the way. And although I always think as a parent that part of my job is to get my kid into therapy, so anything I can do to get him there, I've done my job. But the other takeaway is that we're all afraid of other stuff, like all of us. And in some ways, that's good. We're going to talk a lot about humanity and emotion and connecting with your customers through those things. So it's good to have these moments where we're able to be vulnerable with each other. It helps us relate to our customers better. Now, I have actually worked in digital and in digital marketing for a really long time now, almost since smartphones were a thing. And I'm going to say one thing. I think that we might actually need to update this list of the two fears that human beings are born with. I think that in 2016, scientists should consider adding a third fear to the list. So that today they would report humans are afraid of, born with the fear of falling, born with the fear of loud noises, and born with the fear of getting no love on Instagram. Right? No likes on Facebook. The fear that there's going to be some whole new channel that comes up that we won't even know what to do with. Like, what are you supposed to do with Snapchat? That fear. Can anyone relate to the fear that, like, you're going to spend all this time and money on content and no one will engage with it? I am seeing lots of heads nodding around the room. And there's a ton of talk. This is clearly not an isolated thing. There is a ton of talk in the world of digital, of content, of marketing, of advertising, of creativity, about how we're just kind of creating so much more content than we ever were before. And how people are actually really struggling to engage with it. People are kind of hitting their limits. Now, is anyone familiar with the concept of the monkey sphere? I see one hand. Just note that this soccer ball is not the monkey sphere. The monkey sphere, it's super interesting. It's a scientific phenomenon that scientists first detected in primates. And basically what it is a number. It's a cognitive limit on the number of people, the number of other primates, but for us, that's people, that we can hold in our heads and in our hearts stable interpersonal relationships with. And they first detected it in monkeys. Scientists can actually just weigh the brain of a primate and tell you how many people, how many other primates they can engage with in close interpersonal relationships. For humans, that number is somewhere between 120 and 150 people. And this, I think, is why you're starting to see people like go on defriending sprees on Facebook, take digital cleanses, digital detoxes, digital Sabbaths. They want some rest. There's one line of thinking that says that we're just getting to the place where we're kind of saturating people with content, and they're hitting their mental limits for engaging with it. There's a theory that says that we are all this guy. We are on Mount Content, and that is the peak, and we are almost there. We're almost at a place where people's minds can't deal with it anymore. Now, I don't know if I buy that theory. I see the data on disengagement. People clearly are disengaged. TrackMaven, who's a sponsor of the conference here, came out with a report a few months ago that said that in 2015, content published by brands, the volume of content published by brands was up by 35%, and consumer engagement with that content was down by 17%. And it's funny to me when I come to the East Coast or even to Europe, and I talk to people who are in like CPG or retail or apparel, because they all think that the disengagement problem would be solved if they had an app. But I come from the world of apps, and we know that that's not the case. Actually, Localytics, which is an apps analytics provider, says that 70% of apps that are downloaded will be used less than 10 times ever. And I come from the world of digital health most recently. I'm sure that number is worse in digital health. When they do eye tracking studies on people watching television and television programming, 60% of them avoid commercials just by turning their heads away every time the commercials come on. Not even by like time-shifted viewing or anything fancy, anything technological. And I don't know if you've been seeing all this report on employee disengagement, but Gartner reports that 60 to 70% of employees in America fall on a disengagement spectrum somewhere between kind of neutrally disengaged and actively, toxically hateful toward their employers. Now, you might wonder how that last fact relates to the rest, but the way I read that fact is like, we can't even pay people to be engaged. That is concerning. And there's a lot of people that think that this is a digital era problem. I disagree with that. And I'm gonna ask you, we're gonna have a little bit of church moment if I can make this happen. I want you guys to read this quote with me out loud. Advertisements are now so numerous that they are very negligently perused, and it has therefore become necessary to gain attention by magnificence of promises and by eloquence, sometimes sublime and sometimes pathetic. Now, you can tell by the verbiage, by the word choice of this, that this was not written like last week, right? Does anyone want to guess when this was written? Anyone? Well, I'm going to give you one clue. That is what the guy looked like who said it. And his name was Samuel Johnson, and he was a cultural critic and writer, and he said this in 1759. Right? So I'm a digital chick, but I do not believe that disengagement is a digital problem. It is not a tech problem. Tech didn't cause it. Tech won't fix it. I believe it's actually a human problem. It's a human problem. And what I'm going to talk to you about today is about how to understand sort of eternal principles of what motivates humans, and how to adhere to undying principles of what makes for good content. And I will hopefully share with you some facts about myself and my own career that help you understand how those things have actually helped me be very successful in digital marketing. All right, so a little bit about me. I'm Tara. My background educationally, I have bachelor's and master's degrees in psychology. I have a law degree from UC Berkeley. I actually practiced the law for a while and ended up representing a bunch of realtors who got sued civilly and charged criminally for the same conduct. And that inspired me to go into the real estate business. So I quit my job as a lawyer, I became a real estate broker, and ultimately I was concerned about some of the patterns I was spotting in the car where my clients were telling me that they wanted one thing, but their decision making was really in opposition to what they said they wanted to create for their lives. So I wrote a book about real estate, hoping I could help solve that problem, and got this amazing life-changing phone call one day from HGTV asking if they could license the content of my book as seed content for a website they were starting up. And that was my career change moment. They hired me as a digital content marketing consultant to convert this 400-page long-form book into hundreds of web articles, video webisode series, PR campaigns, and I did that for them for several years before I was recruited by Trulia.com, which is a real estate search engine and was a competitor of that site, to go in-house and run consumer content marketing, PR, and be the company's spokesperson. I left there for the agency world. I worked in consumer tech PR agencies, also as a VP of digital and content, and then had my own small marketing firm in San Francisco, which is where I work and live. I got this call one day from my fitness pal, which I had kind of heard of at the time. My fitness pal was then and is now the world's largest health and fitness app. Are you guys familiar with my fitness pal? Some are, some aren't. It's a nutrition tracking app. People have lost something close to 300 million pounds using this app. I got a call from my fitness pal, and I thought I got a call from them because I had started to do some work around creating a customer insights framework called the Transformational Consumer, and I'll tell you what that is in a minute. The call I actually got from my fitness pal was, hey, we have 45 million users, and we don't have a marketing team. So, like, should we have a marketing team? And if so, what should they do, and what should this, like, framework for them be, and what should the org chart look like, and what should the budgets look like, what programs should they run? So I took what was supposed to be a three-month engagement to help them understand those things, and then, as Bernie mentioned, on the sixth month that they asked me to come just run the program as VP of marketing, I took that job offer. And it was a fantastic job. In the time I was there, I was there slightly under 2 years. In that time, we grew from 45 million to over 100 million customers. When I came, we took an $18 million round of funding, and right before I left, we sold to Under Armour for $475 million. One of the statistics that I'm the most proud of with my team is that we actually increased engagement on the app. We increased customers' willingness to actually use the app by about somewhere between 22% and 25% just on the marketing team, not including what product did in the time I was there. And I'll tell you a lot more about what programs we ran to do that and how that worked in a minute. What I do now is that I'm the founder and chief executive of Transformational Consumer Insights. We help companies engage with customers that fall into this category. They are people who spend a lot of their time and their money on trying to change their own behavior for the healthier, wealthier, and wiser. And we do that largely by customer search and strategy consulting, but also by publishing data and trend reports, and training teams and doing thought leadership around this work. So what I want to sort of start to get you to think about is that there are a number of primal motivations, primal reasons that people do the things they do, including buying a thing or choosing one brand or over another. And one of those primal motivations is transformation. People want things to be different in their lives than they are now. That force for transformation is particularly powerful when you're talking about people's drive to want to be healthier, wealthier, wiser. We're not going to talk about that piece a ton today. What I want to talk to you about is a little broader, so it can be applied regardless of whether your brand is a garbage bag brand or a gaming app or whatever. But it's hard. You cannot really tap deeply into the motivations of humans unless you understand them and understand what they are. So the first thing that I want you to do in that vein, I'm just going to give you a few simple mandates, and then I'm going to share with you the way that we think about them and some examples from my work at MyFitnessPal. The first thing I want you to do is to rethink your customer. Most of us think about who our customer is through the lens of, like, they're actually already a paying customer, they've used our product in the past, they are following us on some social media channel. And I want you to sort of zoom out and think about your customer through the lens of anyone who is dealing with the problem that your company exists to solve is your customer. major key on this one is to, when you think about problem, define the problem from a big human scale perspective. Define the problem that your company exists to solve from a big human scale perspective, okay? The problem is not, the problem you exist to solve is not how to get people to buy what you sell. There is some bigger problem that your company exists to solve that does, that could help heal humanity, and you gotta go there with the way you think about this problem if you want to actually tap into people's deeper human motivations around it. Let me give you some examples. Do you guys know what Slack is? Slack is essentially like a group chat, a group messaging platform. But when you hear people at Slack talk about what Slack is, they talk about wanting to create more collaborative workplaces. They talk about wanting to help people be more productive, right? What is your company's problem? When I was at Trulia, Trulia is a real estate search engine. The problem that could have been stated in terms of, we want to help people find homes. But the way we talked about the problem at Trulia was always, we want to help people make better decisions about their home buying process. We want to help people create their vision for their lives through the home buying process. And when I came to MyFitnessPal, you know, 80% of people who come to MyFitnessPal app use the app to lose weight. So when I came to MyFitnessPal, they were very, very focused on weight loss as the problem that we existed to solve. But after some time on the executive team and really sitting down and hammering this out, we decided that as a company, we had a bigger issue. We were actually angry at the world, the status quo of the world. We were angry at the truth that it's much, much easier to live an unhealthy life than it is to live a healthy life for most people. So we decided that the problem we wanted to tackle as a company was righting that wrong situation. And so that's the problem that we started thinking about our customers through the lens of. Anyone was our customer who wanted to live a healthier life than they were living right then. The next step is to become the expert on your customer's journey. You and your company have to become the expert on your customer's journey. Now, the thing that I see marketers in particular do is to start to think about their customer journey through the lens of their customer's life cycle with their product or within their content flow, okay? And I'm asking you to zoom way, way out. We're talking about becoming the expert on your customer's real life journey out in the real world of trying to solve the problem that you've decided your company exists to solve. All right, now this requires something a lot of people don't want to do, customer research. There are all levels of customer research. Customer research is any way that you can actually engage with your customer. But remember, the definition that we were talking about of your customer is not just people who already have bought your product or already follow your social media channels. It's all sorts of people who are facing the problem that your company exists to solve, right? So customer research could include online listening. Customer research can include if you're a fitness product, going into the gym and hearing what people have to say in the gym, spotting patterns in what they're saying, right? And it can include engaging research firms. There's a whole big spectrum of it. Whatever you do when you approach customer research to rethink your customer, don't break the number one rule of customer research. The number one rule is do it. So don't break that rule. I think what I am starting to see is a real over-reliance on data, on usage data, to the exclusion of actual insights about real human beings by sitting down and talking to real human beings, right? And so I'm actually a fan of data. When we do research at our company, when we did research at MyFitnessPal, we always kind of start with some level of like data that reflects the business challenge that we're helping solve, data that helps us understand, you know, what the contour of the marketplace or the size or the scope of the marketplace is. We want the problem to be big enough that it's a worthwhile problem to solve. And then we also, on the other end, always validate our human and naturalistic and real life and behavioral scientific observations with, you know, surveys or with more usage data. So we like to use data at beginning and end, but we always spend a lot of time just understanding humans and talking to people. So there are a million ways you can do customer research, light resources, heavy resources. But some of the things that you should, your ultimate goal is to actually create a map, a visual, graphical map of their journey from having the problem to no longer having the problem. So for us, it was from living an unhealthy life to living a sustainable, healthy life. Let me talk to you about the things that you're looking for in the process of creating a customer journey map, and I'm going to tell you about them in the context of what we did when I came to MyFitnessPal. When I first came to MyFitnessPal, I asked, like, what do we know about these people? What do we know? I mean, I had actually lost almost 70 pounds, but it was like almost 20 years ago. So I lost my weight way before there were smartphones. And I knew that I wasn't necessarily representative of an average MyFitnessPal customer because, frankly, I had lost my weight and kept it off, and most people don't. So I didn't want to start drawing conclusions about how we could market to those people based on what my experience had been. So I asked, what do we know about people who want to live a healthier life than they're living right now? And what I was told was that all of the customer research that had been done up to that time was user research of existing users in San Francisco. They just would call San Francisco users into the office and sit them down and talk to them and ask them questions. This, I thought, was problematic because San Francisco. San Franciscans are not representative of anyone anywhere else. They spend a lot of money on stuff that's crazy to other people. They use personal consumer technologies, you know, way before other people, and sometimes use things that no one else will use. They eat weird stuff. So I thought, we gotta get out of San Francisco first thing. And that's what we did. We went to six cities all around the United States, and the qualifying question went from, are you using MyFitnessPal? Can we talk to you about the features and what you would like? Two, are you trying to live a healthier life than you live right now? And if you answered yes to that question, you made it into the possible list of candidates for our ethnography work. And it was a hoot. We went out into people's homes, we went to the gym with people, we talked with their loved ones, we got into their pantries, we got into their fridges. There is a thing in research where, like, you can ask people a certain amount of things and they will tell you all kinds of answers. And then when you actually observe their real lives, you will see that those answers may or may not have been true. Like the woman that comes to mind for me all the time is this woman who kept saying she was paleo. She follows a paleo diet. And I'm very knowledgeable about that program. And just it wasn't matching up for me. She was really, really struggling with her weight. And so, you know, we talked to her about it. She showed us all her paleo cookbooks. She, like, told us the whole thing. Then when we got into her fridge, I saw all these really huge, like, mason jars of colored liquid. And I was like, what is that? And she says, it's vodka. And I'm like, oh, OK. Why is it red? It's Jolly Rancher infused vodka. So I called my photographer over and was like, hey, can you just, like, take some pictures of this? And I said, it's vodka that she put a Jolly Rancher in. She goes, oh, no, you put 12 in each jar. 12 Jolly Ranchers in each jar of vodka is not a paleo diet item. What we were looking for and what we ended up doing, I wish I could show you the detail on this map, but I cannot anymore because it's proprietary MyFitnessPal and Under Armour now. But what we were looking to do and what you should look to do as you do customer research is create a visual map of the customer's journey that identifies, like, recurring universal patterns in stages of their experience on their journey. So you're looking for, this is a pattern spotting exercise, right? And it is messy because people are messy. So you will get out, you talk to people, or go online and do a lot of online listening outside of your own channels, right? On other people's sites, on other blogs, on other media outlets. And you start literally just spotting patterns in the stages that people go through. You want to also spot patterns in what gets people stuck and what gets people unstuck between stages. Okay? Sorry. What gets them stuck and what gets them unstuck. So the things that get them unstuck, I call progress triggers, things that help people form habits. Like for us, one of the big progress triggers early on in the process of going from unhealthy to healthy is when you actually start to see visual results or you start to feel like, you know, stairs that were hard for you to walk up, like, now you just find yourself getting up them. Or you tried to run a mile and you couldn't, and now, like, you could. Those things help people move to the next stage. And there are all manner of things that get people stuck, right? There are, we call them quit points. There are decision shortcuts and decision traps. People get bored, all kinds of things. People get frustrated that progress isn't happening fast enough. I spend a lot of time actually studying behavioral economics, like the behavioral science behind how people are irrational in their decision making, because I think a lot of product and just brands and businesses generally see a big problem that they want to solve, and they're like, okay, here's the problem, here's the solution, but humans don't make decisions like that. Human behavior change doesn't work like that. So understanding what people gets people stuck and unstuck. Then you're also going to look for two other things, micro moments and natural language. Now, micro moments is a term that Google actually came up with, and it just means all these moments increasingly prevalent in our lives where we immediately look, when something comes to mind, we immediately look to our devices to look it up. So they break them down into four categories. I hope I get them right. It's like, I want to know moments, I want to go moments, I want to do moments, and I want to buy moments. So you want to figure out where on your customer's journey they have those moments, and you want to spot patterns in the natural language that people use about their journey and about their problem and their process. And I'll tell you what you can do with that information in just a second. So once you... That didn't work. Once you have a customer journey map and you've isolated these things, you've isolated the universal sort of stages that happen, you've inventoried what gets people stuck, you've inventoried what gets people unstuck, you know where your customers' micro moments are, where they're turning to devices to like do research or figure out where to go, and you have started to spot some patterns in their natural language, you will have all manner of engagement marketing superpowers. Trust me, everything works better once you have this information, everything. Here are some very concrete ways that you can use that information to create engaging content. The first is that you can use the journey map itself, including all of those things, the stuck points, the unstuck points, the stages, to create a set of message pillars that you're going to build your content strategy on top of. The thing that this requires is that you have a content strategy and that it is built on a set of messages that will span all of your channels, all of your efforts. Some companies don't, and I encourage them to. when you are starting to think about or rethink your message pillars, in the wake of knowing that your goal is customer engagement and knowing what your customer's journey on their problem looks like, the thing that I ask brands to do is to shift their thinking from, our job is to publish messages that are big, beautiful messages and stories about our brand. Two, our job is to publish high-value content about our customers and for their journeys. Okay? That immediately will cause a shift in your engagement. You're publishing content about your customers and for their journeys. It's problem-solution, and I'll share with you some examples of that in a second. Oh, the other thing is, you can and should use what you spotted in terms of natural language patterns that your customers use to phrase your message pillars in their natural language, not in yours. Okay, I'll give you an example. At MyFitnessPal, we ended up talking a fair amount about how you can't hate yourself skinny. That is not corporate speak. It is the thing that people were talking about all the time, was trying to motivate their health programs by like the fact that they hate this thing here, or you know, whatever. It doesn't work. So we would do programming specifically around you can't hate yourself skinny. And if you are using, if you're using your own language versus your customer's natural language to deliver social media messages, content programming, it will instantly ring very, very inauthentic. And I'm gonna share an example with you from when I was like 8 years old. So I'm 8 years old, I'm in the grocery store, I'm in the produce section with my mother. And I look up and I see the sign for collard greens. You guys know what collard greens are, yeah? The sign for collard greens says, collard greens, main ingredient in traditional Black American hot salad. I've never known a Black American that thought about collard greens as salad, right? So like the inauthentic, if you're using corporate speak to describe things in a way that's wildly different than the way your customers are describing them, it just like instantly clicks them off. And the opposite is true. If the power of natural language is that it gives you insight into your customers' mental frames around your subject matter, and it allows you to instantly alert them that they care about your content because it already fits within a frame of, this is important to me. I care about this already. Natural language. All right. The second thing you can do is to take the journey map and the micro moments to get really granular with your content strategy. Now, journey and language to create message pillars is a sort of macro. Message pillars are like, you know, basic and span everything that you'll do in your content program. Journey and micro moments creates, it should inform your very most granular content strategy decision making, right? Micro moments tell you where your customers are online at any given moment in their journey so that you can make sure the right content reaches them on those channels at the right moments in their journey. I'll give you one big example that covers all of these in a second. And the last thing is, I want you to think about the process of customer research and online listening as not just a process that ends when your journey map is done, but that it's an ongoing practice that you'll start to build into your company. Whoever is responsible for monitoring social media metrics and content performance metrics should also be engaging in some level of online listening, basically forever. There are several things that will empower you to do. And it's interesting, on my team, I always hesitated to have the people who were creating content read the comments, because comments. But if I had the resources to have someone like, you know, filling my dashboards up or managing Track Maven, which we actually used, I would have that person. I would always try to not have it be the person who actually created a piece that is looking at that language, because it's actually just super stressful for people to do. So that's just like a tip on execution. The things that ongoing online listening and real-time sort of optimization of your content based on what you're seeing in content performance data does three things. The first thing is it just makes your marketing better. I know we get exhausted with these conversations about data and data and data and data and data and metrics and analytics and data and data. But it does actually make your marketing better if you are watching what people respond to and what they're not. The second thing that it does is it makes the business case for more resources. And Bernie mentioned this in his introduction. A lot of marketers that I know that are creating beautiful content and social media campaigns struggle with getting the resources they need to go bigger and do more. Having data and being able to report that data back up that shows, like, people are really responding to this. Here's what it would look like if we built that into a whole program. Helps you make the business case for the resources that you need. The third thing that it does is it just makes real-time innovation happen. When someone on your team is constantly monitoring, like, the new, what is the natural language? How are people talking about this issue now? You know, even the best content, and we were like literally a world-class content program there, it doesn't work necessarily forever, right? People's attitudes change, other media outlets change, the content mediums change. So I say, instead of being fixated, the message pillars should not change. Like, what you stand for and the kinds of solution-oriented content that you're going to deliver to people, that shouldn't change over time. What should change is exactly, you know, the execution of it, and that you can change specifically, effectively, only if you're monitoring your data really closely. I don't know if you guys read a lot about lean methodology. Does that ring a bell for people? In my world, a lot of people think of that as something that's just applied to like product design, and I think of it as something that I apply to marketing. So before I spend a ton of money on anything, I would always try out a message, try out a phrase, try out a topic, and then if it worked really well, I'd say, hey, this is why we're gonna spend so much on this whole big campaign, because it just worked. All right. Oh, this is like the overachiever tip. This is why it's in white. Many teams, one journey. So there is a bad thing that happens, especially in the world of health and in the world of personal finance, but it happens in all sorts of worlds, where different teams in the company are operating against different understandings of the customer journey, right? So the marketing team has gone out and like done this exact work, and they actually kind of understand where people are. It's always the marketers that, like, frankly, kind of know. Because marketers, especially digital marketers and social media marketers, you get constant real-time feedback from, you know what people are engaging on and what they are not engaging on. Whereas like the product team or research and development team may have a much longer feedback loop between the time they do work and the time that they know whether it worked with customers, right? I encourage you very, very strongly, if you're like, and if you want like an A plus in life and an A plus on your career, and you have the bandwidth to do it, to start thinking about how you can serve as the voice of the customer in your company in a bigger way than just on your team, in a bigger way than just for your content. One thing that we do when we do research projects for companies now is, even if marketing has hired us, we will essentially recruit and include members from every team in the company, including HR, including operations, including engineering, at key stages of this customer journey and customer research process. The thing that happens when you do that is that when the journey process is done, you end up with like a squad of change agents already like kind of on board, who've already been in it. And then in engineering meetings, when they're talking about doing something that, you know, frankly, what happens is marketers are saying one thing, this thing is healthy, and then the product is actually like not healthy. Or they're saying, this is like, we help you make great financial decisions, when actually you're just helping them spend more money. So if you can get that squad of change agents kind of cultivated and involved in the process during the research process, you have people who can help you make sure all of the teams in the company are working on the same customer journey map. So what we found when we did the MyFitnessPal research was this. There were three big sort of, there were a million takeaways. There were three things that were instantly actionable and kind of surprising. They were around cost, they were around cooking, they were around calories, right? So the number one thing, every single, in the first city we went to, we talked to 12 people, every single person, when we asked them what the biggest obstacle to living a healthy life was, said the cost of healthy food. That was actually a fact that no one in the company had ever heard before, because San Francisco. The second thing was cooking. So people expressed a number of obstacles to being able to cook at home in the evenings. And what we knew, because we do, we believe in like that perfect marriage of like data and humanity, we knew that our users on the app who were cooking at home were vastly more successful, whatever their health goal was. People who cook at home lose 40% more weight than people who don't cook at home. People who cook at home on a day they cook at home are 60% more likely to stay under their sodium goals, their sugar goals, their calorie goals. So like cooking was a thing we knew we should be trying to understand why people weren't doing. So we got this intense list of reasons that people were not cooking at home, even though they wanted to. And then calories. People who were starting to understand calories were struggling to put together filling healthy meals within their calorie ranges. So we literally took those things and programmed message pillars directly to them. We programmed cookbooks that had meals within specific calorie ranges that we knew were very common ranges for those meals. We created all sorts of recipe content, lots of meal planning content, lots of budget-friendly meal content. And then we just built this like amazing content program. So we had it hubbed at the blog. We started the blog with zero readers. In 9 months, we were at 10 million monthly uniques a month. We drove, you know, a 22% lift in weekly active users, a 24% lift in monthly active users. And this was literally just really basic, like, if we need this result, we have to do this. So we needed people to come in who were within our sphere. We had their email addresses, but they hadn't been on the app in a long time. So we sent those people emails, really optimized with topic and subject for what we knew people needed. But then once we got them into the app, we actually programmed the content into the app itself, so that even if somebody didn't feel like they could log or wanted to necessarily log their foods, they would have other things that were valuable to them, other reasons to keep coming back in. The super beautiful thing about this program was that the product and engineering teams bought so hard into it that we ended up, we were creating recipe content and content to help people cook at home. And the product team was building features to help people log recipes that they had cooked at home, features to help people log restaurant foods at the same time. So we were all trying to solve the same problems. And it was kind of a beautiful thing. So I think that's all I want to say about that program. I feel like I've thrown a lot of like big principles and mandates at you. I do want to say that there is a really systematic, comprehensive way that you can approach these things. That is actually what we use when we do them with customers. So we, once we do a customer journey map where we've isolated the stages, we've inventoried the quit points, we've inventoried the things that get people unstuck, we actually proceed through each of those things through these different lenses. There are like key takeaways from behavioral science and economics, persuasive product design, which is design of computing and design of content to help change behavior, coaching and narrative, helping your customers understand that they are living one story now and there's a potential new story they could be living, and helping them be equipped with the capabilities, skills, and resources they need to move from old to new. And then organizational change management, we actually have as a core competency in our company, because if you deliver all these beautiful recommendations, you should do this with your product, you should do this with your content, and can't help people sell it in throughout their company, nothing actually happens, and that's sad. And we don't want to be sad. there are systematic ways to proceed through those things. I generally give this talk with about 15 more minutes than I have right now. And so I have all these books, YouTube videos, TED Talks that I tell people that they should read and watch and listen to. If you would like that list, just email me at tara@transformationalconsumer.com. If you think we should work together, email me there. If you want to confess to me what your fears were, email me there. If you also have pugs that are very demanding, email me here. Or add me on LinkedIn and just tell me this is where we met. And that's actually all I have.
All right, terrific. Thank you, Tara.
Thanks, guys.